back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Al Bayezid Nasir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia, and that is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana.
A massive public outpouring in Peshawar, the regional capital of Pakistan's northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Anger is boiling in Pakistan like elsewhere in the Muslim world over Israel's atrocities during the 11-day long conflict, which the United Nations said could amount to war crimes. Pakistanis are particularly furious over Israeli troops for desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds, Islam's third holiest site. Similar protests have also been held in major cities against Israel's plans to evict Palestinians from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds.
We have a very deep-seated love for Palestine. It is a part of our belief system to live and die for Palestine. And that is why such a huge number of people have turned up in this protest.
The ongoing protests are mounting increasing pressure on Pakistani government to help Palestinian militarily to prevent another Israeli aggression. Pakistan has backed Turkey's demand to set up an international protection mechanism to prevent Israel's aggression in future, although the scope and reach of such a mechanism have yet to be established. Analysts believe that some non-Arab countries can form a joint military coalition in not-so-distant future.
We want the government to support us. We will go to Palestine to defend our brothers. But if Israel fights with us, then we will hit back.
More mass anti-Israel protests are expected in the coming weeks and months as different opposition parties are planning demonstrations across Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
According to British daily The Sun, the US is going to follow a complex strategy regarding the withdrawal of its troops from Afghanistan. The Sun reported that Washington is going to keep hundreds of its forces in the country in order to avoid the collapse of Kabul by Taliban. According to the report, 600 US Marines could be deployed to protect the US embassy in Afghan capital. British and Turkish troops may reportedly assist the US forces. However, experts here believe such a move is part of Washington's psychological war against Afghans after spreading further fear among locals.
The US is after wickedness. It threatens us of the consequences of its withdrawal, such as the fate of women's rights. But we ask them to just leave our country. We know how to deal with the challenges.
In the meantime, many here name the US government as a symbol of imperialism that doesn't care about basic issues such as peace, human rights and liberties.
It's very naive to think that American came here to do anything with poverty, to do anything with peace building, to do anything with democracy or human rights. It's in fact, it's the other way around. American presence, not in Afghanistan, but in the region and in the world, in the bigger picture, is to create more conflict, is to create more poverty, is to create more dependency to the United States.
As observers say, the U.S. and its allies want to draw a dark picture for the future of Afghanistan under such a scenario. The Afghan government will soon collapse by the Taliban and the country will go back to 1990s. In such circumstances, political elites in Afghanistan say, since Afghans have fully experienced the cost of foreign interference in their country over the past four decades, they need to firstly come together and make a united nation and then make a strong policy to deal with foreign players in line with their own national interests. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters gathered outside the BAE Systems factory in Blackburn in the north of England to call upon the weapons manufacturer to stop supplying components for F-35 fighter jets that have been used in a recent bombardment of Gaza.
BAE, which is one of the largest companies in the UK supplying arms, parts of jets, fighter jets, to the Israeli terrorist state, which is bombing children, killing innocent people, and BAE is also funding other oppressive regimes like Saudi Arabia, and their arms are destroying the lives of innocent people.
The protest came on the back of one of the largest pro-Palestine demonstrations in British history on Saturday, and similar demonstrations throughout the week led by Palestine Action Group, who have been protesting outside the Israeli-owned Elbit Systems factory that provides drones, weapons and military hardware to the Israeli army.
We've seen protests in Leicester, Tamworth, Oldham and today in Blackburn as the anger amongst the British public begins to swell at the thought that British weapons are being used by the Israeli army to kill Palestinian children.
They're shooting kids, they're murdering little children. If that was their children, what would they say? So us lot standing here, we're going to stand out here and we're going to make noise for our people, our brothers and sisters are being oppressed. Free, free Palestine!
The name of the Jewish people is being misused. And the term anti-Semite, so-called anti-Semite, is being thrown around. Anyone who dare criticise strongly what the Zionists are doing is labelled as a Jew hater, and it's not true.
It's become increasingly clear that the British government's unwavering support for Israel is not representative of the feeling on the ground, with more than 383,000 Brits calling on their government to sanction the Israeli regime for their crimes against the Palestinian people. But while the UK remains complicit through the hundreds of millions of pounds worth of weapons sold to the Israeli army, some might wonder if the UK should also be held accountable. Ahmed Cabello, Blackburn.
To continue supporting the Palestinian cause, Yemen Zakat Authority has organized this event to distribute cash aid among the Palestinian community in Yemen and fundraise $1.5 million to the Palestinian resistance.
Today, we are honored to launch two projects. The first one is distributing cash aid among our families and brothers from the Palestinian community. We're also donating money to support the Palestinian resistance.
The head of the Zakat Authority said the Palestinian resistance proved it is capable of standing against Israel. Yemenis said what was presented in the ceremony is part of what is coming, as Yemenis promised to support Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands.
There is no doubt that the amounts provided by the General Authority for Zakat are a simple contribution from the Yemeni people who are ready to even share their food with the Palestinian people. Yemenis hope that this money will help liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli occupation, and we believe that the Palestinian resistance is capable of doing this.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, called on Yemenis to stand by Palestinians, saying they will share a living if they have to. He urged Yemenis to carry on the fundraising campaign to help Palestine.
Despite being involved in a brutal war by the Saudi-led coalition, Yemenis say they will also stand by their Palestinian brothers with everything they have, even if they have to share a living. Abdul Latif Washali, Sana.
The seven candidates of Iran's 13th presidential election appear on TV and radio channels to convince voters by giving details of their programs.
This time, due to the corona pandemic, campaigns mainly go on through TV channels and social media platforms.
My first priority is the production. I will boost the country's production and fight economic corruption.
The other one said it is time for a revolution in management methods and mechanisms of running the country.
It is time for deeper changes. A revolution is needed in management, which means an administration that fully merges with the people.
The next one was Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who said that production and creation of jobs will be among the top priority issues to be addressed.
I will take a serious step toward production and creation of jobs in the beginning of my administration, which is due to start in the second half of this year.
Abdonasser Hemmati, who is the current governor of Iran's central bank, emphasized that today nothing is more important than improving people's livelihood.
We must boost production through interaction in order to improve the livelihood of people.
Mohsen Rezaei, who has vied for the post several times, said he would appoint women in his administration.
Definitely, I'll use women in my cabinet, and at least two of my cabinet members will be women. The housewives would also get the necessary facilities to be able to earn money.
Earlier, Ebrahim Raisi also noted that the participation of youth in the electoral process will create a bright future for economic independence and prosperity. Campaigning for the seven candidates got underway on Thursday and will continue until the day before the election day. Human Abadi, Tehran.
According to Afghanistan's public health ministry, the third wave of COVID-19 is sharply spreading across the country and the government is bracing for the plight. As officials say, the government's decision to put a two-week ban on nearly half of the educational centers and universities is considered a precautionary measure to avoid further spread of the disease in the country. The public health ministry has also urged locals not to violate health protocols. However, locals here believe that attempts like this must be associated with other supportive measures by the government in order to convince ordinary people to stay at home.
Our people can't survive without government's financial support during lockdowns because poverty is widespread. Most families here can't survive if their breadwinners stay at home.
In the meantime, some others suggest that closure of educational centers and universities is not enough and that the government must put a ban on activities of all public sites such as swimming pools, wedding halls, sports clubs and even religious sites.
Confronting the third wave of COVID-19 can be fruitful only if the public and private sectors take it seriously. So all public sites, including swimming pools and wedding halls, should also be put on lockdown.
As observers say, the Afghan government will have a tough task to confront the spread of the third wave of COVID-19 pandemic due to shortage of medical equipment. This comes despite receiving millions of dollars in aid by regional and international states and bodies. Based on official figures, over 70,000 Afghan individuals have been affected by the disease so far, and some 3,000 others have also lost their lives over the past year. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Activists are galvanizing opposition to the government's planned controversial policing bill, which is now close to becoming law, highlighting a number of issues as more Kill the Bill protests are planned.
It's a massive assault on our democratic right to protest in this country. Let's be clear here. This is specifically aimed at the environmental movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding that we tackle the climate emergency, and the Black Lives Matter movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding justice for black people. And when the government saw these two movements in the summer of last year taking to the streets as they did, they decided that they needed to put in place the most draconian legislation.
Many anticipate a new wave of protest as concerns over the right of assembly grow.
I think this will be the government's poll tax movement moment, and we'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cities right across the country, as we have over the last 3 months, stepping up the campaign against this bill. But it's an absolute disaster for democracy in Britain.
The bill could also have a devastating impact on other marginalised communities in Britain.
This government is conducting a culture war. That's what he's doing. He's trying to undermine and eliminate aspects of black culture, Muslim culture, traveler culture. And when you think that people have had a way of life for thousands of years, and now you're going to introduce legislation, rather than facilitating their way of life as British people within a multicultural democracy, you're actually going to introduce a law that denies them their very way of life.
Criticism of government plans will continue amid fears that the potential damage might be irreversible.
The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill continues to see mass opposition up and down the country, with experts deeply concerned about the potential long-term impact on civil liberties. Richard Sudam, London.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The debate.
News has emerged that the U.S. used Denmark's Secret Service to spy on top European officials, including the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her then foreign minister Frank Walter Steinmeier. Even though the U.S. would not admit to this, didn't the former intel contractor Edward Snowden reveal that the U.S. government was spying on its allies? Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at the depth of the U.S. spying and whether the U.S. was the only one that was spying on its allies and the reasons behind wanting to spy on its allies. First, let's cross on over to Paris. Chris Dunhand joins us. Well, Chris, tell us about this, the spying allegations, how true it is, and the countries that are involved in this.
Well, the French Europe Minister Clément Beaune reacted immediately by saying that if these allegations are proven to be true, it's a very serious matter and it must be investigated very seriously. Also, Germany reacted immediately by saying, by asking clarification, because there is alleged spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and former Minister Steinmeier. These are really top European politicians. The Denmark defense minister declined comments on these allegations, but he admitted that spying of allies is unacceptable. Now, the strange thing is that since the Edward Snowden affair in 2013, who revealed that the CIA and the National Security Agency, NSA, spied on its own citizens and also on its allies, apparently since 2013, nothing has changed. That's maybe one of the questions for the debate, because Snowden, as a famous whistleblower, he has been sanctioned himself because he has been threatened as a spy himself. He had to leave the country and to find shelter in Russia. So the Danish media revealed that the United States continued spying on its allies even after the revelations of Snowden. So this is a very serious matter. It's not proven yet, so the first reactions of top European ministers like Clément Beaune are rather strong, but it has to be seen how far they will go and how far they can go in finding proof for these very serious allegations.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Chris Dohan there from Paris. Let me bring in journalist and independent political analyst Geroy Coleman, who joins us also from Paris. Geroy Coleman, welcome. So what are we looking at over here, and what is your reaction? I mean, if we want to break it down, which we're going to get into, but the news initially reads Denmark's Secret Service helping the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, to spy on European leaders, and included the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and and now President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. What's your reaction to that?
I think this needs to be understood in the Russian-German geopolitics and the U.S. role in that. We must understand that Denmark is a key player in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project between Germany and Russia. And this is something that the United States have been trying to sabotage for a very long time. And they've been putting pressure on various European countries to do that. In particular, France has been exerting a lot of pressure on the Germans to pull back. Germany is very much involved. They're very much in favor of going ahead with this project. And Denmark is a key player because in October of last year, the Danish Maritime Authority gave the go-ahead for the construction of Nord Stream 2. And again, in January of this year, construction started. So I think we need to sort of understand that that's the geopolitical context in which this revelation has been made. The revelation itself is not major. It has been known for a very long time that the U.S. spies on Europe. I mean, they spy on everyone, and they spy on their own politicians, they spy on their allies. In this, in the game of geopolitics, there are no friends, there are just interests. And major interests here, of course, are billions of dollars in energy contracts. And that is really, I think, the context in which this, in my opinion, in which this story is sort of breaking right now. Denmark has been force of quite a lot of controversy recently, also with the migration crisis, where they stopped migration flow into Denmark, and that created a lot of controversy as well. So that could also be linked, of course, because there's a lot of politics around the management of this, of the migration crisis. But to come back to the oil pipeline crisis, I do think that that is the center, the key issue here behind this espionage revelation.
Okay. Let's bring in Mike Harris. He's an editor at Veterans Today who joins us. Mike Harris, welcome. So I don't know if you heard what our guest there said. I'd like to find out from you, first of all, the general conception or the general understanding of spying is that everyone spies on each other. I don't think I should say the U.S. takes the lead on that, but does it? And is it also true that they all spy on each other? And of course, the immediate question is, why would allies want to spy, in this case, the U.S. on Germany, let's say?
Well, let's answer your question in three parts here. One is, that's what intelligence agencies do, is they spy. And they do this through bribery, human compromise, blackmail, in order to bend people to their will, in order to get them to do things that they normally would not do. They do this in an effort to direct policies that would be beneficial to the people of their own country, to change those policies so that they're beneficial to the U.S. or whoever the spying agency is. So that's the first question. And I'll quote, everybody familiar with the phrase from the Godfather, Don Corleone, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, which really was he quoted that from Sun Tzu. But the issue is that that is the nature of intelligence agencies. That is what they do. They spy on friends, allies, enemies, everyone. It's what they do. And domestically here, the U.S. intelligence agencies are spying on our own citizens, which is really quite unconstitutional and unfortunate for those of us who live under what is becoming a very authoritarian regime.
Okay.
Number two is no, the U.S. is not the most prolific spying country in the world. We're rivaled very closely by both Israel and China at this point in time. They're both been very, very active, internationally and domestically here in the U.S. So those are two of your questions there. So it's an unfortunate thing when they get caught at it. But as the previous guest had stated, there's a lot of money at stake. There's money on the table here, and it's pretty obvious to the entire world that the Biden administration is for sale.
Okay,
they're here to.
Mike Harris, I want to make sure that I understood the first part of what you said correctly, because I'm going to throw that onto our guest Gerard Coleman. And you said that spying is done in order to have countries do what, let's say, the U.S. wants, and to guide towards the U.S. goal in a particular I don't know, in a particular environment conducive to what the U.S. wants. Is that what you am I correct to understand you that way? That countries spy on each other to get information to guide and push that particular country towards, let's say, a policy that the U.S. wants to enact, for example?
Yes, exactly. And we see the same thing in our country, that Israel does the same thing to us and our politicians. They're constantly spying and constantly blackmailing our politicians to bend us to their will.
Okay.
So this is pretty much universally accepted way of doing business in the intelligence community.
Okay, Jacques Coleman, so do you agree with that? And can you give us examples, if you can, in the case of Nord Stream 2, if that applies, how it is that this is coming in that context, and whether the U.S. is going to be able to get Germany to follow what it wants, which is not to go with Russia on this?
Well, yes, I would agree with the fact that Israel is the key security threat to the United States because of the overwhelming control they have over the telecommunications industry and increasingly the internet. Just recently, there was a meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu and Lindsey Graham. And Lindsey Graham said, Senator Lindsey Graham said that more than Five Eyes, the Five Eyes, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, the official kind of spy alliance of the United States, Britain, and Australia and New Zealand. He said more than the Five Eyes, Israel was the eyes of America, essentially. So they have, and they, of course, they said they do sell that information to the Chinese, which is, to take up what your other guest said there. China's power very much depends on its ability to get information from Israel, and Israel has easy access. So, there are no allies in this game, as far as I can see. There's just, interests, and because of the interconnectivity between the corporate sector, big business, and intelligence, the military-industrial complex is so complex that it's very difficult to tell and to control information. One of the things that sort of comes out from this crisis again and what emerges becomes very clear is that Europe has no sovereignty whatsoever, and any pretensions it has of defense, of mounting a defense policy is ridiculous. It has been a project of the United States since the Second World War, and it continues to be, play second fiddle to the United States. So, the idea that, politicians are shocked by this, I just don't buy that. I think they've known this for a very long time, that, the U.S. spies on them. But of course, as your guest said, the French have spied on the Americans too. It's not anything new. The big question here is, why is Denmark in the middle of this?
Right.
There's no proof that Danish intelligence services have done anything untoward or have done anything that any other state has not done. I think the geopolitical issue I discussed there is probably the reason why there's a focus on blaming Denmark right now, because they are the Danes have given authority to Nord Stream. The European Union is against it, and I think now they're sort of ganging up on Denmark.
So, Mike Harris, why was the Danish government involved? Why did it decide to actually work with the NSA? And proceed in what, like our guest there said, and what has been revealed, that it actually spied on many countries in Europe. So the question, in cooperation with the NSA, but why Denmark in this case?
Well, if you look at Denmark's strategic position here with the global fiber optic network, that puts them at a very easy access nexus there, where they can filter and take in information from both east and west, all of Europe, all of Russia, all of North and South America. Everything goes through a hub in Denmark. And that is why Denmark was a very, very logical insertion point for the spying to take place. That's really what the rub is there, is where can you get access to what's going on over the fiber? And Denmark was one of the places.
Okay. Jacques Coleman, let's take this a step further. The whole spying thing. It is reported that when there are, for example, UN meetings that take place, whether it's in New York or whether it's in Europe, that anywhere these countries and the representatives are, in terms of, let's say, the foreign ministers or the diplomats, they're being spied on, and they're being tapped, and they're being watched. And whatever intricacies are involved in their thoughts and in their policies, it's being listened to, extracted, and then there's a reaction. Are we looking at policies being changed, altered, and then presented based on the spying that takes place? Because if that's the case, then I don't know if you see where I'm going with this. There's going to be a whole series of events that could happen that would not be to the betterment of whatever cases may be presented. In this case, I use the example of the UN.
Well, I think that, you know, we're in a situation where we're essentially living in a matrix, in an information matrix, where everything is being spied on. Every citizen is under surveillance. And that is increasing. I mean, as the, you know, this scandal broke today in France, as they were discussing it, you know, they're passing laws to put biometric identity cameras all over the place to make sure everybody's wearing a mask and to make sure everybody's doing what they're told, and further laws which enable them to track people on the internet to see what you're looking at, to see what and to listen in. This is happening almost by the week. You have more and more violation of privacy, and so we are moving towards a world where essentially everyone, every citizen, is under total surveillance. And of course, that is going to affect our behavior, because we have to be careful about what we say, and you have to. So, if you're in a, when it comes to state level, obviously, it poses a major problem, because again, there's a question of who has this access to this information, and how can a state have any sovereignty? But of course, the question of sovereignty presupposes that there is such a thing as a nation, and we've seen the last 20, 30, last half century, that the nation has been one of the things that the oligarchs wanted to destroy. And so there really isn't any sovereignty left in these countries anyway. It's really just corporate interests and the interface of corporate and media and industrial interests. There really isn't any national interest left, in my view.
Well, the thing that's very perplexing here, Mike Harris, is the fact that when we take a look at Denmark, what has been reported is that the Danish foreign and finance ministries, for example, the Danish intelligence helped the U.S. spy agency, NSA, to spy on them. So basically, you're having the Danish spy on their own ministries. And then you also have a Danish intel ministry to help the U.S. spy on its different ministries, which then means that the U.S. is spying on itself. Doesn't quite make sense that you're having this Danish ministry spy not only on its own country, but then having the U.S. spy on entities within the U.S.
Or any other government that there is. You have to look at it that there's a they're not a monolith. They don't all think in the same manner. You have different factions. You have different elements in there with it, which have different goals. Now, in the question of Denmark as to why their own intelligence agencies would be spying on other ministries, you have to ask why. You know, are they being leveraged? How are they being leveraged? And by whom and to what ends? Or are they in agreement with goals that the U.S. has that those ministries needed to be checked somehow? Maybe the intelligence folks didn't feel that the finance ministry was acting in the best interest of the Danish people. This is a complex issue that I have not had the time to do the analysis on, but there's always competing interest within any government, whether it's the U.S. government, whether it's the Danish government, whether it's the British, French, German, whatever, and they have different goals, and how they achieve those goals is really kind of up in the air, and this is a game of constant leverage, constant pressure as to how you can get other people to do your will, and that's really what the whole spying issue is about, is to getting people to do things they wouldn't normally want to do, but you leverage them by bribery, blackmail, human compromise, whatever, to make them do what it is you want for fear of being exposed for some other nefarious reason. But that is the business of what the intelligence agencies do. That's how they gain their power. That's how they exert their power, is through those vehicles of bribery, human compromise, and blackmail. That's what they do.
Okay, taking all those acts that our guest there, Mike Harris, said, Gerard Coleman, can you give us another example that, in essence, there's manipulation that happens based on the different acts that our guests there said? If you can give us an example, you talked about the Nord Stream. If there are any other ones of significance.
I didn't get the last big segment there, unfortunately.
Mike Harris talked about how it's being used as leverage, the information that's extracted through the spying. I'm asking whether you can give us another example, aside from what has happened with Nord Stream, of this being used as leverage or manipulated to obtain the goals of the certain countries who are doing this. Let's, for example, the U.S. or any other country you can give us an example of.
Well, there, I mean, threats, I presume your guest mentioned threats. You know, you can threaten people with death, for example, accidents can happen. I remember a few years ago, there was a helicopter accident Angela Merkel had. There was no official mention of a conspiracy to kill her, but it was a rather unusual helicopter accident, and they had to land, make an emergency landing. These are the kinds of things that, you know, can happen when a leader is not playing ball. You know, plane crashes have been known to happen. The French, for example, during the Cold War, got rid of many African leaders that way by organized plane crashes. So these are classic, I guess, these are classic assassination techniques. So, you know, that can happen. And of course, you can have coups, color revolutions. Obviously, that's not going to happen in Germany because it's already playing ball on more social issues. So this is a much trickier dossier, I think, for the U.S., how to stop the pipeline project. I mentioned the role of coercive engineered migration, which is where you escalate a migration crisis to put pressure on the state. And we saw examples of that 2016 crisis, where the Turkish leader Erdogan was leveraging the refugees and the migrants, and threatening the EU in order to get to gain, you know, bargaining power. So these are things, for example, I mentioned earlier that the Danes had already created controversy because they had closed borders to foreign migrants. I mean, that's something, you know, we could see that escalating perhaps in the next few months, where the Danes are under more pressure with far more migrants coming than they previously would have thought. So there are many examples of that, and there are, you know, these are the kind of tricks that intelligence agencies play all the time.
Thank you very much for that. We're going to, unfortunately, end the debate. We're fresh out of time. Krista Hahn, of course, wanted to spoke at the top of the debate. Editor at Veterans Today, Mike Harris, thank you for your thoughts. And journalist and independent political analyst, Gerard Coleman, there from Paris. And that is it for this edition. Do join us for the next one. From Mikko Vitale, entire team is goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's view on death. If you remember, we discussed the issue of death in different religions. Death is sometimes used for body and sometimes for the soul and spirit. When it is used for body, it means that the body has lost the ability of any movement. But when death is used for the spirit, it means transferring from one phase to another. It means the separation of body from spirit. According to the ayahs of the Noble Quran, the angels do not take the soul of human beings. In the same way, they take the soul of some people with respect and ease, while take the soul of others very harshly. The Noble Quran says in Ayah 32 of Surah Nahl, "Those whom the angels take away while they are pure, they say, 'Peace be to you,' enter paradise because of what you used to do." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Death for a faithful is like smelling good smell, which causes him to go to light sleep, and all pains will leave him." In view of Islam, the best kind of death is martyrdom, meaning dying in the way of God. In Ayah 154 of Surah Baqarah, God says, "And do not call those who were killed in Allah's way dead. Rather, they're living, but you do not understand." It says emphatically that those who are killed in the way of God should not be called dead. According to the Noble Quran and the words of the Prophet and his infallible successors, most of the human beings are not able to sense the realities of the unseen world due to barriers or curtains that have covered their soul. The righteous welcome death as they know what awaits them in the hereafter. But sinners are scared of death, and when they near death, they think of repentance while it is useless. The Noble Quran says that the repentance will not be accepted. Ayah 18 of Surah Nisa reads, "But repentance is not for those who go on committing misdeeds. When death approaches any of them, he says, 'I repent now.' Nor is it for those die while they are faithless. For such we have prepared a painful punishment." God says elsewhere in the Quran that the Pharaoh repented at the time of being drowned in the sea, but God didn't accept his repentance. Islam says that the real owner of everything, including human soul, is God. And whatever he gives us has in fact been entrusted to us. That's why the religious leaders never lose their patience in the time of sorrow and demise of their near and dear ones. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said in a message to his companion, Ma'az ibn Jabal, who was impatient and restless at the death of his son, I have heard of your restlessness for your son, whose death God has ordained. Indeed, your son was a sweet gift of God, and one of his trust with you. He made you enjoy him for a while, and at the time that had been determined, he took it away. So, indeed, we belong to Allah, and to him do we indeed return. The Prophet soothed Ma'az's heart with these words. Imam Khomeini, as a true student of the Prophet's school, was a top example of patience in the way of Allah. When he lost his elder son, Haj Agha Mustafa, due to the conspiracy of the Pahlavi regime in a mysterious operation, he didn't even cry in public, although his son was a noted scholar at Islamic seminaries. One of the companions of Imam Khomeini relates his memory of those days. I never saw a drop of the Imam's tear for his elder son, Haj Agha Mustafa. He recited the ayah, Indeed we belong to Allah, and to him do we indeed return, and said, Mustafa was the hope for the future of Islam, and we lost him. Moreover, when he went to the tomb of his son for the first time, he was firm as a mountain and behaved very normally. This is while everyone was crying and weeping. He came in among the row of the attendees and asked very solemnly, Where is Mustafa's tomb? Then he sat at the tomb, recited Fatiha, and dealt with the issue very normally, and then returned. Dear listeners, although Imam Khomeini was very patient at the death of his son, he would be very sad and cry intensively at the martyrdom anniversary of the Prophet and the infallible Imams. This would surprise those who had seen the Imam at the death of his dear son. Late Haj Isa, one of the servants of the Imam's house, said, Unlike the patience of Imam at the news of martyrdom of his dear ones, he would weep very much at the ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Mr. Kosari would elegize, and the Imam would become very impressed and would sit down crying intensively. He also said, At the time of martyrdom of Agha Mustafa, the Imam didn't cry and restrained his sorrow. The people around him decided to elegize. But the more the elegies read out, the Imam didn't move at all. But as soon as the elegy for Imam Hussein began, he started weeping.
Good morning.
Good morning.
beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is...